Nicholas Johnson's term is up at the Federal Communications Commission, and the word is out that President Nixon is going to replace him with a man from within the television industry. That means an enormous change at the FCC, since Johnson is known as a critic of the industry. Of course, he's a critic of everything else as well, including the commission itself.
I came to the conclusion that the FCC was hopeless, and that the only way to achieve anything in these areas was to bring pressure to bear from the academic community, from research organizations, from foundations, from public groups, from the Congress, from the courts, from the mass media, that was the arena in which these battles were going to have to be waged and either won or lost. At that point, I went outside of the accepted mode of behavior for FCC commissioners, and therefore that created a sense of alienation on the part of those within the mold of accepted behavior at the FCC, and nothing I did before or after that was going to be of much help.
And that wasn't long after President Johnson, no relation, appointed 31-year-old Nick Johnson to the post in 1966. Enormous and, I think, significant changes have taken place in the man over the course of that 7-year appointment, and this program is an effort to sketch them in. Johnson's critics, mincing no words, say he's evolved into a hippie, pointing to his casual appearance and lifestyle, and of an almost perfect record as the only dissenter in the usual FCC unanimity. Kenneth Bacon covers the Federal Communications Commission for the Wall Street Journal. How would he describe Johnson's career at the FCC?
I suppose the first word is exciting. It's always refreshing to have a character like Nick Johnson come to Washington and shake up the establishment and provide a new viewpoint that most regulatory commissioners aren't likely to provide because they're so closely allied with the industry or with various constituencies that are pretty much regular. And certainly the FCC is going to be a lot duller without him.
He's rocked the boat.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. You can use all the standard words, gadfly, maverick, etc., that have been applied for the last 7 years. But I think from the FCC's point of view, internally, Johnson has forced them to address a lot of issues that they may have overlooked without him. Johnson came along and suddenly realized that to be effective, he couldn't limit his scope of action just to the FCC. He had to reach out and try to bring in consumer groups, viewers, etc., and get them interested in problems which he felt were very important.
What do you suppose it was that turned him around, made him a gadfly? I mean, when he was first appointed, certainly his outward appearance wouldn't have made you guess that he was a gadfly. He had short hair and nice shiny shoes and a tie and a jacket.
Well, he still has a tie and a jacket.
Although he doesn't know where they are.
I don't know. You know, he'd been a maverick as a maritime administrator, and he'd been there for a year or so, and he so irritated the maritime industry that, the story has it, they put pressure on Lyndon Johnson to get him out of there. So Johnson put him on to the FCC, some people say, where he'd be only one of 7 people and wouldn't be the only fellow in charge of decisions. He's always felt that people ought to participate in government, and it shouldn't just be appointed or elected officials, but democracy means everybody. And he's tried to put that into effect. And he says once he got to the commission and found out how disorganized it was and how lacking in goals and policy ideas, that he decided, I've got to blow this place open.
Was it something new, Ken, for him to think of the television audience as a group of consumers? Was that a new idea?
No, I don't think it was a new idea. But I think what Johnson did was actively go out and solicit viewer response and tried to organize and tell people how to organize into viewer groups, mainly tell people how to organize into viewer groups, to say, look, if you're dissatisfied with the programs you're getting, here's what you can do, A, B, C. You can monitor the programs. You can go talk to the management and say, we don't think you're giving us enough local programming. We don't think you're giving us enough public affairs programming. We think you run too many commercials in an hour, and we think some of the commercials are even fraudulent or whatever. And if the station won't reform or change from this pressure, then they can go to the commission, and they can follow through with a number of legal remedies.
In one of the articles you wrote about Nick Johnson, you indicated that there was a certain body of opinion that as he became more extreme in his personal style, his influence within the commission diminished.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. He, I think, was regarded as sort of an odd duck on the commission, And
From the first.
No, not from the first, but certainly the last several years. And of course, the commission now, the Nixon Commission, if we can call it that, is a tamer animal than the Johnson Commission. It tends to be a little more homogenous and maybe a little more industry oriented than the Johnson Commission than the commission under President Johnson's administration. But I think Nick Johnson sacrificed something. He obviously made a decision that he could speak his view and forsake the support of other commissioners, or else he could try to compromise and wheel and deal from within, and he decided that wouldn't be as effective as trying to work on the outside and sort of try to build a consumer viewer movement. And he's a guy who has lived through very active times and has decided that, has watched them and learned and decided that people ought to speak up, that we shouldn't sit quietly by, and his view is watch what government does to us. We ought to take a part in it, object if we want to. Now, just look at Johnson's legal assistants. They've gone out across the country, and they're now teaching in law schools, or they've set up public interest law firms. That's sort of a nucleus of characters who are now interested in changing broadcasting, and they're activists, and they're smart, and they're hardworking, and they have Johnson's views.
A legion of bright young men and women who have passed through Commissioner Johnson's office on the way to becoming Ralph Naders of the airwaves. Now, Johnson's support comes from the strangest places. Michael Schwartz speaks on behalf of a right-wing group called Stop Immorality on TV.
I think that directly he hasn't had that much influence by himself, but he has motivated a great number of people across the country to become active and become interested in what's being broadcast and by whom and for what purposes. And I think that no small measure of the activity of groups such as Action for Children's Television and my own group and the National Association for Better Broadcasting and things stems from the interest that Johnson has aroused by saying, you know, the public should get involved and speak its mind to broadcasters. They are not in an ivory tower owners of the media. We are. We the people are.
That's an interesting argument. You're saying in that respect he was a force for good.
I think by and large he was. By and large he's been a valuable contribution to the FCC.
But surely there are points with which
there are points on which I disagree with.
What are some of those points?
One of them would be his doctrinary insistence on free speech. He is always campaigning in favor of responsibility by the media in their hiring practices, in their commercial messages. He's against free speech if it's for advocating violence, for instance. But on any other issue, the performers and the scriptwriters have carte blanche as far as Johnson is concerned to say what they will. And in this, I think he contradicts himself. Because the primary thrust of his work with the commission has been to say that the broadcasting industry is not a sacred cow. The broadcasting industry must be responsible to the public. Yet, when the broadcasting industry does something which is highly offensive to the public and in which the public demands that it stop doing it.
As judged by what? The letter-writing campaigns?
Letter-writing campaigns or simply people sitting at home and turning off the TV, which is what's happened in most homes for the past 20 years. Then Johnson brings up the sacred cow of free speech. He says as long as they're saying something, whether it deserves to be said or not is not the important question. The fact that somebody who has a TV camera in front of him wants to say something thereby gives him the right to say it. And this is as silly as saying that somebody who owns a TV station has the right to advertise his own materials 24 hours a day.
From the point of view of Canada, the American networks are retrograde in the language they permit and the subjects they permit and so on. Whereas if you go to Canada and turn on your radio, you'll hear something entirely different.
One reason for that is that a large percentage of the thought in Canada, at least, is influenced by French sources from a French tradition, which doesn't have a puritanical streak in it. The French are an unpuritanical people. And they can handle topics with greater ease. They don't have the same necessity to guard themselves. For instance, I would imagine that pornography is not that big an industry in French-speaking Canada, because French Canadians simply aren't that fascinated by the topic. Puritanical people, like the American people, are, and it's a great danger for them.
You know, I think your argument about Commissioner Johnson has a hole in it. If what you claim Johnson stands for is true, there would be a kind of self-censorship and no need for people like you.
I disagree, because very few people read Nicholas Johnson's books or read his speeches or read his actions with
the commission. You said he was an influence in terms of
He's been an influence in getting people like the leaders of Action for Children's Television and the leaders of Stop Immorality on TV to realize that they can do something and that they can motivate other people to do it. It goes down a chain of command, and the general public still doesn't know that it can do anything at all. The average ordinary person walking down the street will accept whatever is broadcast on TV and say, well, you can't change it. It's like taxes.
So just to sum it up, Nicholas Johnson opposes you on points 1, 2, 3, and 4 that you make, but you're glad he's been around because he's helped to join the issue.
Because I agree with him in most of his basic premises. It's just his political ideology, namely that anything goes as far as free speech. He seems to be blind in that particular aspect. And that's the only thing I find wrong with him.
So even the smut pickers have a warm place in their heart for Nick Johnson. It was he, after all, who showed the TV viewer of whatever conviction how to stand up and be counted. This is an endorsement Johnson treasures, but it was hardly one that could have been predicted that summer day in 1966 when he first walked into his new office.
Well, I guess my first action was try to find my office, and then when I found it, I found all the furniture had been vandalized, and the next thing I tried to do was get supplies out of the supply room, and I found out that FCC was out of number 2 pencils and paper clips and didn't know it because it didn't have any inventory system, and at that point I was beginning to get an understanding of how this agency functions.
But substantively, how did you try to prepare yourself for this new area?
The same way I would in any new area. I go to the library and I get the books, and I just do a lot of reading. And after you've done enough reading to know who it is you should be talking to, you then start talking to people, interviewing people, talking to leaders in the industry, in the academic community, in the media, people who've studied communications, who have some ideas about it, some sense of what the problems are, who the people are.
When did you start to develop the reputation of being a maverick, of being the one lone vote against everybody else?
Well, I've never thought of myself as a maverick. I just think that if you're a public official, you do the public's business. It's just about that simple. I take the job seriously. I take the act literally. I take the Constitution of the United States literally.
Well, I appreciate what you're saying, but nonetheless, it is true that very often you have been the one vote is it 7 against you? Is it 6 or 7?
Yeah, 6-1.
6-1. And I'm wondering when this reputation started to form.
Well, obviously, the reputation started to form as soon as the votes started to be recorded. All I'm saying is I don't think of myself as some kind of an oddball or some peculiar political ideology.
But you certainly were different. You didn't fit in here at the FCC, and you can judge that by seeing which way you voted.
Well, all right, but I suppose it's the old business about everybody's on a step except Johnny. But it seems to me that the positions I've taken have been so obvious and so logical, so compelled by the Communications Act, by the Constitution, by decisions of the courts. My point is that's not what I set out to do. That's not my goal. That's not my desire. It's not my wish.
Well, let's put it this way.
That it's worked out that way, really, but I have seen that I really had no alternative, no option.
But you yourself have changed a good deal over these past 7 years, isn't that right?
I think that's happened to anybody who gets exposed to establishment power in the United States. You become very disillusioned, very cynical. You discover that, as someone said, one of the lessons we've learned from the Irvin hearings is that people with short hair who wear coats and ties can lie. I mean, I begin to understand who these people are and what they're like, and that there's no reason to have any great awe or bow down to them with any great respect. And just go ahead and lead your life the way you believe in it and what you think is right, and just go ahead and do it and stay relaxed.
Well, this is the period when a member of Parliament, Pierre Elliott Trudeau, was showing up in Ottawa wearing sandals and an ascot, and you were sort of in the same mold, as it were.
Well, I think Trudeau was ahead of me by a few years, but gradually we looked to Canada for our leadership and advice and counsel in these matters, so I think Trudeau was ahead of many of us. But when somebody said had to wear a tie. And I said, well, you know, where I went to school, we always judged a man by what he had above his neck rather than by what he had tied around it.
You were also becoming at this time what I would call a consumerist.
Well, I try to become what I call a non-consumerist. I think a part of the...
You mean a non-consumer?
Non-consumer, that's right. If by consumerist you mean somebody who's concerned about the problems of consumer, yes, I am. Yeah. But
you don't buy as much as other people.
No, I buy very little. I buy very little. I mean, I just want to get by on as little as I can possibly get by on, because I find that I just live a happier life that way. I mean, it's a hassle to have to take a car to a repair shop and have to get your blender fixed and your garbage disposal goes out. And I mean, every one of those trips is, I mean, I don't take any great pleasure out of shopping or talking to repairmen or fiddling with this stuff myself.
What I find interesting, though, is the fact that you can live without a car and without a great many plastic devices, and your total needs, you say, are $3,000 a year. But at the same time, you are interested in the problems that other consumers, big consumers, have.
Oh, yeah, sure, sure. No, I think these are matters of personal choice. If people want to spend a lot more money than they have buying things that they don't need, that are hazardous to their health, that contribute to their unhappiness and misery, I think they have the right to do that.
Why would a man who only needs $3,000 a year be so fascinated by the problems of consumers as you are?
Well, I think, in part, of course, in recent years, I have been interested in the problem of consumers. The fact that once you call yourself a consumer, you've got 90% of the problem. And that I think that the greatest thing that needs to be done in what we call the consumer movement now is to change the name. I really do. I just think that that we're so hooked on the extent to which our identity and our feelings of satisfaction and our worth as an individual is a function of the products we consume, that that's what creates the problem for us. Now, once you've become a consumer like that, once you buy a lot of stuff and clutter up your life with it, then something like the magazine Consumer Reports is very useful to you. I call that the Sears Roebuck catalog for intellectuals. I mean, as long as you're going to buy an electric carving knife, you might as well get an electric carving knife that doesn't have an electric shock hazard, and one that'll cut the meat faster than any other electric carving knife, and one that won't fall apart, and one that has the longest life, and so forth.
Of course, you yourself wouldn't be interested in buying it under any circumstances.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think the much more fundamental question is why do you buy it at all? There's a marvelous passage in Thoreau's Walden where he observes people going down the road carrying furniture on their backs, and he says it's like the animal gets its paw caught in a trap, and then it has to drag that trap around behind it all the rest of its life. And he says, if you're going to do that, you ought to put your paw in a very small trap. But you also ought to ask yourself, at the end, says, why'd you put your paw in that trap at all? You know, why do you bother with all those possessions and all that stuff in the first place? And I feel like I bought something from Sears Roebuck, and it's taken me 3 years. I still haven't resolved it. I'm trying to pay them for it. I got my paw caught in their computer, and I can't get it out. It just goes on and on forever. Well, there are things in life that give me greater pleasure than carrying on this correspondence with this machine that company has. I'm just really sorry that I bought a pair of khakis from them. Boy, if you wonder what I bought a pair of khakis because I wear khakis instead of men's suits. But... it's still going on now. It's 3 years. It took me 2 years to get the catalog from the company, you know. I mean, they really don't want to sell you things anymore, these big companies. They just sort of exist, and they go on.
One of your books is called How to Talk Back to Your Television Set, and I want to ask you whether you believe, as many people in the broadcasting industry in this country do, that commercials are a necessary evil.
Well, no. Commercial television is the business of selling the audience to the advertiser. It's the audience that's the product, and the advertiser who's the consumer, and the broadcaster is doing the selling. The commercials are the central feature of this equation, and that puffy stuff that occurs in between the commercials is something that nobody really cares for except for one purpose, and that is, how will it contribute to sales? The purpose of the stuff in between the commercials is to hold your attention. Television is a gigantic attention-getting device. Well, if you walk down the street and there's a flashing neon sign, you're going to look at it. That's why most people look at TV.
A statement that properly sums up Commissioner Johnson's attitude toward the industry he was charged with regulating. It was a period of Spiro Agnew and Archie Bunker, both of whom, in a way, represent the Johnson spirit of protest and free speech. Well, nowadays, the outgoing commissioner isn't looking for a new job. He wants to loaf and invite his soul, think, read, and write. He sees himself less as a leader than as a philosopher. But you can get long odds in this capital if you think Nick Johnson is just going to sit in a corner and watch the world go by. This is Stephen Banker for the Demand Side in Washington.